Yes, under our streets and our houses is a subterranean world of pipes and tunnels, of sludge and sewerage. The undercurrents, the utilities that maintain our existence above ground. Tunnels can make some people fearful and claustrophobic. They can also offer a kind of metaphor for what's going on in our minds sometimes too, for where we're at in life, a dark place maybe. Oddly enough, my next guest, Dennis McIntosh, experienced both when he descended into a tunnel underground, and emerging 7 years later, something really big had shifted for him. It's a story he tells in an evocative little book called The Tunnel. He's also the author of Beaten by a Blow, and he joins us from the ABC studios in Katherine. Welcome, Dennis.
Good morning, Natasha.
This is a story that takes us back some years now in your life, but it marks a big enough shift for you to, I guess, want to write about it. What was the tunnel that you found yourself in, 80 metres under the earth?
Well, it was the Western Trunk Sewer Project from Werribee to the West Gate Bridge in Melbourne's outer west. And we were construction workers, and I just finished shearing. And I was trying to find my way around, you know, to be at home more regularly. And this job came up, and I didn't think I could work underground. I was always in the bush, in the outback, and but I really didn't have many choices. So I put in for it and got it.
Yeah, what a contrast. The life of a shearer to the life of a worker in the kind of bowels of the earth.
Yeah, it was a shock. You know, going down the shaft for the first time, I'm looking up and, you know, the temperature's getting cooler and cooler, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't think I can cope with this. But walking across the yard before I started, I thought, this is it, because I'd been through so many jobs trying to settle down after the years of shearing that I thought, I've just got to decide to stay somewhere and stick it out. So I thought, this is it.
Yeah, and there's this wise, consistent mate of yours that features in this story, Ricky. And he felt that going underground, taking on this job and sticking at it to the end of the tunnel was somehow going to be good for you. Why did he think that? What was going on for you?
Well, I'd stopped drinking, and I was very unsettled. It sort of disorganises you a little bit. It disorientates you, and I needed that stability. I needed continuity. And, you know, the thing they say, he said to me that 80 metres underground, 2 kilometres inside from the shaft. He said, that's good deflation for your ego. He said, that'll be great. So I accepted that, you know. It was learning to be a bit humble and come down. You know, when you stop drinking, when you go through those things, you're often high as some sort of avoidance strategy. And it just brought me down to earth. It kept me down, kept me real.
I think the wake-up call for you was seeing your little kids looking back at you after one of your drunken rages. What had alcohol become in your life?
Well, it was sporadic, but every time that I, you know, started drinking, I went on these they were horrific. You know, the destruction was, it was just total destruction of the family. I could, you know, you'd come to and you'd see that you're just sucking hope out of your family, out of your wife, out of your kids. And I came home that particular day and I thought, what am I doing? You know, I wasn't drunk. You know, I'd been drunk. And I came inside and saw them, and it just hit me, the damage I was doing to those children and to my wife and to my, broader family.
What was in their faces that day?
It was a look of fear and pity, I suppose. Even the children, they loved me, they looked confused, they looked scared, but they, at the same time, they wanted to come and hug me. And I just stood there paralysed by it. It paralysed me. It polarised me.
Yeah, it's a motivation if ever there was one. You were thrust into fatherhood at a really young age, and I mean, you got a shaky start, but your eldest daughter, Nicole, got an especially shaky start. What happened to her as a bub?
Well, we'd gone shearing up in Bourke, up in New South Wales, and she was only five weeks old, 23 weeks old, sorry. And she'd had colic. And we just thought, you know, my wife was young, the milk was gushy, it was only a matter of time, but she didn't seem to get better. And then one night we got some medicine from the chemist, and she just took these small salam spasm fits. And we didn't know what to make of it, but after she'd been crying and screaming for hours, she fell into a deep sleep. And we went to bed pretty silent. Actually, we were 18 and 19. We were so young.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call during the week because you can't, you know, they had to ring the farmer, and the farmer had to come out to the shearing shed and tell the overseer, and then they had to arrange for me to go and use a telephone to ring midweek, and she'd been put in hospital.
And the prognosis was not good at all, was it?
No, they feared straight away that it was a form of epilepsy called hypsarrhythmia, and that proved to be true. It was generally associated with a severe brain injury, but at the time they couldn't find any brain injury in her. They looked and they did EEG scans, but they didn't have MRI scans or anything like that at the time. So it became a bit of a mystery as how it had happened, but we just accepted the consequences.
Yeah, you accepted the consequences, kind of, but what you did, despite the struggle with alcohol, you have been totally dedicated to this now young woman and who's doing incredibly well in life. And this relationship that you have is just intense and extraordinary.
Yeah, well, my wife and I, you know, we did a little bit of therapy, but she just went backwards and backwards. It was soul-destroying. I came home from Bourke, say, 3 months later, and she'd been a bouncy baby, and even though she'd started fitting, she still looked good. And I thought, there's nothing wrong. I thought they were exaggerating. I was in denial. And when I came home a couple of months later, she was like a vegetable on the floor. You know, she had dribble sores on her chin. Her eyes had become cross-eyed. Mm. She'd gone floppy. I picked her up, and her neck flopped back. It was dramatic, and you know, terribly soul-destroying for both of us.
But you worked on this whole physical therapy targeting what we now know and understand to be brain plasticity. There you were crawling for a kilometre a day or something like that, well, on the floor with her, doing extraordinary things in her childhood.
Yeah, well, my then wife had seen a poster. They had posters then about people who'd come back from America with this program for brain injured children. Now, the program has been discredited ever since. But we had nothing to lose. We went along, we had a listen, and we joined up, and basically it worked. Yet, I thought it's the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And we do this cross-patterning. When I went to work, my wife would get community workers in, and they'd hold her down, and we'd do all this cross-patterning. And then when she progressed from that, we put her on the floor. And I used to crawl with her because she wouldn't crawl on her own. And I think we were meant to do 100 or 200 metres a day. But I'd stopped drinking, and she became my project, which is sort of what you do, you know.
You need a project.
Well, if you're a bit obsessive like that, and she became my project. So we built it up to a kilometre a day. And we'd be walking on beams.
Carpet burn on the knees.
Well, I had to
in
wear,
your case.
I had to wear long pants because the carpet, absolutely, you're correct. But she did it, and we learned to do it, and there was a whole range of activities that we did with her. And she had a breakthrough where we came in one day and she never looked at us. She seemed very vague or distant. She had improved, and then one day she looked at us and started babbling, and it was like we'd broken through.
There she was.
It was one of those amazing moments in your life, you know.
And So let's descend back into this tunnel.
Okay.
Because you had an epiphany some years into this work in the dark, underground, that was inspired by your daughter's progress, and it was an epiphany about yourself and how you felt about yourself and your future. What was the environment like underground? Who were you working with? This was, you know, filthy work, it was dark, it was claustrophobic, you had some panic attacks. This was hard stuff.
Yeah, well, I was down there in Boots's crew, we're calling Boots, and a team of us, and we'd go in, we're doing rotating shift work, building this formwork, and this particular night shift, Boots had gone up to have a barbecue about 3 o'clock in the morning. So that's sort of lunchtime. And I didn't want to go up because one of the guys had died and we didn't go to his funeral. And I thought they'd be drinking. And I just felt that we weren't strong enough to have a day off work. So anyway, I sat there and then I started thinking, here I was, 80 metres down, 2 kilometres, somewhere under the Westgate Freeway.
Yeah.
Right, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting there, and it dawned on me that I'm sitting there waiting for someone to come along and find me, someone along to come and say, hey, you haven't had a drink for 3 years.
Well done you.
Well done you. Hey, you've paid your bills. You've paid your taxes. You've been home every night, you know. Come with me. You've earned it. Or someone to see some talent in me. I wanted someone to see some talent in me and get an opportunity. And the thing about what people don't realise about those sort of jobs is there's no opportunity because you do the same thing every day. You don't progress. And I'm sitting on this drum and I'm thinking, how come I didn't get an education? There's my daughter who had a brain injury, had a really difficult start to life. And she's blossoming at school. Like she's had a lot of bullying, but she was progressing intellectually. And I thought, how could she get an education with a brain injury? And I couldn't get one without one. I was kicked out of school. I spent most of my time in corridors. And then I thought, we didn't teach her, we patterned her. Why couldn't I do the same? Because if I thought about education, you think about smart or dumb. And I realised the difference between a smart person and a dumb person is nothing. It's just the adaptation to the stress that you're in. So we put her under a certain stress and she responded. So I started thinking, why couldn't I do that with my brain?
And this is part of why you describe this tunnel that you dug out with all those fellas underground, night and day, for 7 years as your Jungian tunnel.
It was my Jungian tunnel because I went in as a shearer. And I came out 7 years later as a swimming coach.
Yeah.
And it was transformative because two or three years down there and you do acclimatise, you do get used to things, and all of a sudden all your fears come true. You're paying bills at home and you're a robot at work and that's it. Is this where my life's going to end? And if I was going to do something, I had to do it. No one was coming down that tunnel to find me, to give me a break.
Trapped on the inside out is how you describe it.
Yeah, trapped both inside out. I was kicked out of school. I couldn't articulate my thoughts in writing. I applied for jobs, but I didn't have any education. So, you know, that lack of education really came back to haunt me.
Well, speaking of writing, you did start writing. And I should say, Dennis McIntosh is with us this morning. He's written a delicious little memoir called The Tunnel about, well, 7 years of his life that he spent digging out a tunnel. From the western suburbs of Melbourne right through to the Westgate Bridge there, a sewerage tunnel. And so underground, you did actually, I mean, you couldn't spell. You didn't really have much grammar. You started to write. You started to write poetry. And I think it was quite hard for you to talk about this with the guys that you were working with. This was a tough environment. There was a lot of tension amongst everyone under the ground, which I can't really fathom how you all survived together under there.
Well, the thing is, when I stopped drinking and then what I started to do is work less. That's what I started realising, you know, I'm working 60 hours a week, making all this money, not going anywhere. And once I started to slow down, I started to write. And I was writing poetry, but I thought if anyone found out I was writing poetry, I thought I'd be murdered on sight. The other thing we had was we had a lot of Croatians and Serbians and so on, and they'd, unbeknownst to me then, they'd grown up in these totalitarian regimes where everybody was a spy. So if you're writing something down, they'd think you're spying on them.
Oh.
And then it caused so much commotion and it was just, you know, there was the paranoia around that was huge.
But you did get writing and you did emerge from that tunnel 7 years later. And yes, you were a swimming coach and that had taken over every spare moment because for you, time became your new money, as you put it. You took a reverse vow of poverty, which I just love that line. What did you emerge to do? You're in Katherine now. You've got a PhD.
Well, the thing is, I had a motto because if you've come out of a difficult circumstance, sometimes when you think you're doing the right thing because it feels right, you're heading back into destruction. So if you can't do it, do it. If you don't feel comfortable, you're in the right place. If you don't think you fit in, your home. If you've got a blank page in front of you, you're in the starter's hands, because you can't go into transformative learning if you're in a state of knowing, if you're in a state of understanding. And I needed to put myself where I wanted to be. So it wasn't that I didn't know where I was going. I just had to put myself in places I'd never been before and tolerate uncomfortableness in a way that I'd never done before.
7 years in a tunnel to do that. What are you doing at Woogala? Woogala School in Katherine, 120k, southeast of Katherine, I should say, on the Central Arnhem Highway. What's your role in that school, briefly?
I'm the preschool teacher.
Love your work, Dennis McIntosh.
Well, the thing is, what I did when I was doing my doctorate at Adelaide University, I used to come out bush and do my write-ups, and I'd work 6 or 8 weeks, you know, every second term or something. And they got to know me, and they'd ring me up and then say, can you come up for 6 weeks? We've got a bit of this. And so when I finished my PhD, I still didn't know what I was going to do. The book was still in that process. So I came up and I got a phone call to say, would I come out to Katherine? One of the teachers had been put off sick. So I said, yeah, no worries, I'll come out. And I turn up and I have to be the preschool teacher. But it worked out really well. I mean, the principal said to me, you're going to teach these kids to swim, because I emptied the classroom and I put all these tape down like the bottom of a swimming pool. And I've got them crawling and, you know, just...
Doing that physical therapy you did with Nicole.
Doing the physical thing, because... the thing about these young kids, I mean, they're coming out of these environments, and I don't think their brains are ready for learning. And my experience is, like, I was kicked out of school. You know, I had a different approach to learning. So, you know, I thought, okay, while I'm here, I'll take them swimming, do all these sort of exercises along with all their other, you know, learning stuff.
Oh, look, it's a great story. And just in the last 5 seconds we have, what's happened to Nicole?
Well, Nicole's halfway through a law degree. She was a teacher for 10 years. She got into uni, of course, and she's had a very successful life. She's working just in a day job, but she's at the moment been doing a little bit of policy writing for the United Church. So she's going great.
I love it. Dennis McIntosh, thank you so much for making the time for us today on Life Matters. It's a very inspiring yarn that you spin. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Natasha.
Congratulations, Dennis McIntosh. The Tunnel. It's a Penguin classic. Details on the Life Matters website.